Jeremiah and his message to Judah, and now we're looking at Habakkuk. Habakkuk would have lived in the same time frame and prophesied also to Judah. Let's just go ahead and talk about that. I'm going to be very specific with the date here of his message of being between 609 and 605 BC, and I'll explain the reasoning behind that as we go along. But and then the message, of course, is to Judah because that's the last remaining nation. Now, here's the reasonings why we can pinpoint pretty well the ministry of Habakkuk and his message here. If you take a look at the text itself, let's just point out a few items here, and then we'll go through more of it later on, but I want to point out a few items that help us to date the book. Actually, before we get there, let me ask you this question. For those of you who are on Facebook, I posed the question of being prepared to answer the question, why is Habakkuk different? There's something about Habakkuk that makes it unique amongst the prophets. And I'd ask you to go ahead and read this book. It's just three chapters long, very short. Did you notice anything that stood out to you that made it different from some of the other prophetic books that we've looked at so far? Yeah, this is a dialogue. What did it remind you of? Did it remind you of any other Old Testament book? Okay, Jonah. All right, so you have a dialogue there in Jonah that you also have here in Habakkuk. There's another Old Testament book that it reminded me of, especially considering the content of the dialogue. Job. Okay, so let's talk about the content and see why that's comparable to Job. What is this dialogue that's back and forth in the first two chapters between Habakkuk and God?
He initiates the conversation. The prophet initiates
the conversation rather than God. Okay. That's something that's different about it too, is that usually whenever there is a, with a prophetic message, it's, hey, this is what God told me to say. But this is Habakkuk talking to God and asking God, and what is he asking?
How long is it going to be before punishment takes place in the people?
Okay, how long is it going to be before you take care of all the wicked people? Because he looks around him and he sees nothing but wickedness. And so, and he's complaining to God, and we're going to talk about that, about this complaining to God, and is that okay? But he complains to God, so you have this dialogue and him questioning God, complaining and asking, and the God replying to him. And you have two parts of that, where Habakkuk questions God, complains to him, questions him, God answers him, and then Habakkuk asks again and waits for his response, and God responds once again. Okay, so that's one thing that's kind of unique about this, and that's similar to Job for what reason? Same type thing. Now, obviously with Job, the questions were, why am I personally suffering like I am? I haven't done anything wrong. Why am I being afflicted like this? And he questions God, and God answers him finally. Okay, so there's some similarities there. That's something that I think is unique about Habakkuk. What else is unique? When you think about the genre or the type of literature that you find within this particular small book.
Could be more like history than poetry.
Okay, there could be a little bit of history there. It is written in poetic style, though. And specifically, go to chapter 3. The New King James, in verse 1, I don't know if it's the same word in all the other translations, but it says it's a prayer of Habakkuk, and it is. But what style of a prayer is it that we then see throughout the rest of this chapter? It's a song. It's a psalm. And you can see the some of the markers of it being a psalm. Take a look, for instance, at verse 3. God came from Teman, the Holy One, from Mount Paran. And then you have that word Selah, which nobody really knows what it means. It was some kind of musical instruction. We see it, though, in the Psalms quite a bit, don't we? When you read through the Psalms, you'll see that little musical instruction, because these were set to music, meant to be sung and played with music. And you see that, Selah, come up at least three times in this chapter. And then also at the end of the chapter, the end of the book, it says, to the chief musician with my stringed instruments. Chapter 3 seems like it belongs in the Psalms, not in the prophets. So that's something that's unique about it as well, is that you have this dialogue in the first two chapters between God and, or between Habakkuk and God, and then the third chapter is a psalm. So very different than a lot of the other prophetic books that we've looked at or that we will look at. Okay? So now back to what I was going to say. If you'll take a look at some of the things that will help us stamp the date of this ministry of Habakkuk and of his writing here. Going back to what Tom said in verse 2 through 4, you have Habakkuk complaining to God about all the violence that he sees, all the wickedness that he sees. Okay? Now, the last book we looked at, the king that was reigning during Zephaniah was Josiah. And remember, what should we remember about Josiah? Good king or bad king? Good king. And what did he do? Was he the only one that was good? Or what did he do with the nation? Yeah, he got rid of all the idolatry, and the nation itself made a sweeping reform at Josiah's authority and his control there. And so you have, for the most part, the nation following God during that time, and following the commandments of God and restoring the covenant and making an oath to follow the covenant. But yet in Habakkuk, that's not the case. So something has happened here that we know it was would not be during Josiah's reign. And so in 609 BC, that's when Josiah dies and Jehoiakim takes over. Jehoiakim is a wicked king. Okay, and this would most likely be during Jehoiakim's time frame. In fact, let's talk about the history of the events that take place that would help us to see that this is during 609 and 605 BC. First of all, we have the reign of Josiah from 640 to 609. Good king. For the most part, the nation is going to be doing good stuff, not following idolatry. That was not allowed. And they would be followers of Yahweh at this particular time. Coinciding with the reign of Josiah and his sweeping nationalistic reforms, Assyria is weakening. And they're struggling. And Nineveh actually falls in 612 BC. Who does it fall to? What nation conquers Assyria?
Babylon.
Okay, so Babylon is rising to prominence. Assyria is decreasing in prominence during Josiah's reign. But Assyria calls upon some... Now, Nineveh fell, but that wasn't the end. I mean, Assyria wasn't gone yet, but that was certainly a major battle. But Assyria calls upon help from another major world power. Do you know who that was? Think of the ancient Near East. What other nation is always a major player in world politics that's close to Palestine, close to Judah, Israel? Egypt. Yeah. And in 609 BC, you have what leads to Josiah's death, remember, is Pharaoh Necho from Egypt is going up through Israel, through Judah, Israel, but not to fight Israel, Israel's gone, not to fight Judah. But they're on the way up north to try to help Assyria and fight the Babylonians. Josiah makes a boneheaded decision that he doesn't want Pharaoh Necho to come up through his land. And so he goes out to fight him. And Pharaoh Necho says, "What are you doing? I'm not here to fight you. Go back home. Otherwise, you're going to regret it." And Josiah disguises himself and says, "No, I'm going to fight you anyway." And he comes in, and he gets killed in battle. And Pharaoh Necho's like, "I told you so. You should have just stayed home." Okay, so he kills Josiah while he's on his way up to Syria area to try to help Assyria with the Babylonians. So Jehoahaz is made king by the people, But Pharaoh Necho now, because he's killed Josiah, he's kind of taking control of the area. Remember, Assyria's weak. Judah's no longer really that much of a vassal state for Assyria because that whole area is in a state of flux. And Pharaoh Necho takes Jehoahaz. He's on the throne for 3 months. And he takes him off the throne and says, no, I don't want you as king. I'm gonna put Eliakim on the throne. And he changes his name to Jehoiakim. Okay, so that all happens in 609. Josiah dies. Jehoahaz is made king. But Pharaoh replaces him with Jehoiakim. Now, Babylon is wanting control of that area where Judah is. Egypt is wanting control of that area where Israel is, or where Judah is. And so from 609 to 598 BC, you have Jehoiakim reigning. And for the first 3 years, he is a vassal of Pharaoh Necho in Egypt. But then in 605 BC, major world event. You have Nebuchadnezzar battling against the Egyptians. You have the Battle of Carchemish. And Nebuchadnezzar is not king. He is the general of the army at this point. His father is king. And he defeats Pharaoh Necho at the Battle of Carchemish. Later on that year, he invades Judah. And that's the first wave of captivity. And Jehoiakim is still king at this point, of course, but he becomes now a vassal of Babylon instead of vassal of Egypt. Okay. These are the events that's taking place during the time of some of these prophets that we've been looking at, and including the prophet Habakkuk. Now, the reason why we say the prophecy would be between 609 and 605, okay, 609 is when Jehoiakim became king. And 605 is these events here. Take a look at chapter 1 and verse 5. Here's the response of God to Habakkuk. Habakkuk says, how long all this violence, all this iniquity, all this wickedness? When are you going to do something about this? Here is God's response in verse 5. Look among the nations and watch. Be utterly astounded. For I will work a work in your days which you would not believe, though it were told you. For indeed, I am raising up the Chaldeans, a bitter and hasty nation, which marches through the breadth of the earth to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. And then he goes on to describe their cruelty, their wickedness, their lust for power and conquest. So the only time frame that really fits the descriptions of the wickedness that's taking place in the state or in the country of Judah, and the fact that the Chaldeans have not yet quite risen to power and overtaken anything in Judah, is between 609 and 605 BC. And it's still debatable. Who's going to take over in this political vacuum that's left by Assyria weakening? Is it going to be Egypt or is it going to be Babylonia? That's not decided until 605 when the Egyptians are defeated by the Babylonians at the Battle of Carchemish. So that leaves that little small window there. The Chaldeans, the Babylonians, have not yet risen to complete dominance. And Habakkuk and the rest of the people, they're not sure who's going to be the most powerful. Is it going to be the Egyptians or is it going to be the Babylonians? Or even yet, is Assyria going to regain its prominence? They don't know that yet. Okay, so that's part of the dating process there of why we know it's within that time frame. Let's talk a little bit about a simple outline. I already alluded to this. Chapters 1 through 2, you have a dialogue between Habakkuk and God. And then chapter 3, you have a prayer / song of Habakkuk. And let's go through some of this, and we'll be taking a look at some key verses as we go along. So, in chapter 1 and verses 2 through 4, you have the first complaint of Habakkuk. He says, O Lord, how long shall I cry and you will not hear? Even cry out to you, violence, and you will not save. Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to see trouble? For plundering and violence are before me. There is strife and contention arises. Therefore the law is powerless and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous. Therefore, perverse judgment proceeds. Okay, we know this book was written about 2,600 years ago. But could somebody write that in 2015 about our country or about our society? Would it still apply? Do you see our country in this? Talk about the long-lasting, everlasting applicability of the book of Habakkuk. It's still applicable today. We look around us today. What are some of the things that we see as far as wickedness is concerned? That just seems like, I mean, yeah, I know individuals have their foibles, they have their faults and so forth, but what are some of the big things that we see all the time and justice to never seems to go forth?
Abortion,
absolutely. I mean, it's legal murder is what that is. And millions are murdered every single day. Okay, what else? When you read the headlines, what do you see on the headlines? Drugs, murder, homosexuality. I heard somebody else saying something. Okay. I mean, I read a headline just, oh, I guess it was last week. May have been 2 weeks ago. There was a double homicide in Birmingham, pushing it past the totals of homicides for the previous year. So we're already on a quicker pace to, I mean, we've already surpassed last year's homicide totals. And in that article, it was listing the number of homicides over the last several years and showing how back in the 90s, I guess it was even higher than it is now, but had dropped significantly, and so to where there was a point where, and I don't know the numbers, I'm going to make up a number here, but there was only maybe 50-something homicides or thereabouts. And I'm, you know, we get excited that it went down from 90 to 50. Okay, yay, 50 murders. Now, I don't know about Chicago, but I think it's one of the worst. D.C., probably a whole lot more than Birmingham. Is Chicago number one? We're last in all the good things that count and in the top of all the bad things, it seems, at times. You just look around, and this world, our society, is just filled with violence. Filled with wickedness, plundering, violence, strife, contention. And then verse 4, the law is powerless, justice never goes forth. And you see people literally getting away with murder. And, you know, you see people in high ranks of politics getting away with violations of the Constitution, violations of laws, and nothing is done. And we can ask the same question to God. How long? And what are you going to do about it, God? Okay, now let me ask you this question. And this is also reminiscent of the Psalms, this kind, and Job and so forth. Have you ever been taught that you shouldn't complain to God? Okay. I know I heard that growing up, that you don't complain to God. What's Habakkuk doing? He's complaining to God. Okay. So, is he wrong in doing so? Okay. Why not? I mean, after all, God is God, and Habakkuk is Habakkuk. We're just lowly humans. Do we have a right to complain to God in light of all the wickedness we see? All right. I mean, we certainly need to obviously have that fear and awe of God and His authority and His position and where we are on the totem pole.
Do you think God was actually conversing back with Habakkuk? Actually, or was it maybe a dream or something?
It's not. It's not worded that way. It seems to me that this would have been a conversation similar to what we see in Job, where God verbally spoke to him. Regardless of the method in which it was done, God did reveal his answer to him, discussed it with him. But you have him complaining, and the complaint doesn't stop. I mean, we haven't even looked yet at the second part of the conversation. James? Okay. All right. Complain, but don't get in trouble. I like that. What I get the impression that Habakkuk and others before him, Moses complained to God on occasion. Job did, obviously. We see it in the Psalms with David at times. There's a right way to complain and there would be a wrong way to complain. What would be the wrong way to complain to God? Okay, accusing him of?
You can't lose your faith. That's what the Bible said. Regardless of what happens to you.
Okay.
You just live by
faith. I think that's a key component of all of this, is that within the complaints, he never wavers in his faith to God at all, or that God is in control of it. He just doesn't understand, and he's wanting to understand. He wants to know, what's God going to do about it? How are you going to handle this? I know your nature, God. That's something that comes through very clearly, is I know your nature. You're not supposed to let this kind of stuff go on. You can't tolerate this. And so why have you been letting it go on? And when are you going to handle it?
He acknowledges that God can do something about it.
Yeah.
There's a difference between complaining to God and complaining about
it. There you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't see him shaking his fist at God, defiant attitude or anything. You don't see him complaining about God to others. He takes his complaints directly to God. And he addresses God with respect, with awe, with faith, with understanding that God can do something about it and that it's totally within his nature to do something about it. He just hasn't revealed what he's going to do, when Habakkuk is wondering, how long is this going to take? And almost in the sense of a demand, do something about this, God. But we see that many, many times in Scripture, especially the imprecatory Psalms. We see that quite a bit. So I said all that to say this. Sometimes I think that we might be afraid to take what are valid complaints to God, because we don't want to offend his awesome nature, and that's good. That's a good way to be cautious, but I think that we can be bolder than sometimes we are with God and say, look, I have complete faith that you're going to take care of this. I know that this is not right. Please do something about it. Will you please, reveal yourself? Now, he's not going to speak to us directly today, but we have precedent for that, not just in Habakkuk, but in other Scripture as well. Okay, before we move on, any comments or questions about that? Okay, so that's his complaint and his question to God, his crying to God. Take a look at God's reply, starting in verse 5. I already read a little bit about this. He said, look among the nations and watch, be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days which you would not believe, though we're told you. I indeed am raising up the Chaldeans. And as I said, he goes on to describe their lust for power and conquest. And that ends in verse 11. But when you read through that, does God actually answer his question? Okay. He does, but not in a direct way. Yeah, but now his question, though, remember Habakkuk's question is, there is wickedness and evil in Judah. When are you going to punish those people? Okay, and all God says is, hey, guess what? I'm raising up the Chaldeans and they are a mean people. He doesn't actually say what's going to happen, but the implication is there. He implies what's going to happen, and Habakkuk picks up on that. And yes, it's going to be in your days, you're going to be astounded because this is not, well, not only is the are the Chaldeans not yet the dominant world power, but why else would this be astounding to Habakkuk? This was not the answer Habakkuk was expecting. Not because, not just because the Babylonians had not yet risen to world power, to the major world power status, but because they are more wicked, and that's not how he expected him to take care of the wicked in Judah. So, let's take a look at verse 12. Verse 12, this is Habakkuk talking again, and he says, "Are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We shall not die." And I think that what he means by that is that there will be a remnant that will remain. Because he understands that what God is saying is, I'm bringing the Babylonians upon Judah in judgment. So people are going to die. Keep going, verse 12. "O Lord, you have appointed them for judgment. O rock, you have marked them for correction. You are of purer eyes than to behold evil and cannot look on wickedness. Why do you look on those who deal treacherously and hold your tongue when the wicked devours a person more righteous than he?" Now there's another complaint, another question, something else that Habakkuk does not understand. Okay, Lord, I trust you. You are holy. I understand you've appointed them for judgment, but why? They're worse than Judah. And so he goes on to describe the kind of people the Babylonians are through the rest of chapter 1. And then notice chapter 2, the way he ends his complaint to God. He says, "I will stand my watch and set myself on the rampart and watch to see what he will say to me. And what I will answer," I love this, "and what I will answer when I am corrected." Okay, he recognizes, okay, yeah, I'm going to wait for God to answer me, but I also recognize that God's probably got an answer for me that I don't understand. He's going to be correcting me in his response to me. I don't have full understanding of this situation, but God does. And so his basic question there, the second half of chapter 1, is, okay, I understand you're going to raise up the Babylonians to judge us, but why? Because they're even more wicked than we are. And then here's God's response, and here's one of the key verses. It's in this section here, one of the most important verses of the entire Bible, right here. Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 2, "Then the Lord answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain on tablets that he may run who reads it. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it will speak and it will not lie. Though it tarries, wait for it, because it will surely come." It will not tarry. Okay, so in verses 2 and 3, he's saying, okay, I'm about to give you my answer. Write it down. And it's not going to take long for this to take place. And here's his response in verses 4 and 5. "Behold the proud. His soul is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. Indeed, because he transgresses by wine, he is a proud man and he does not stay at home. Because he enlarges his desire as hell," and or Sheol should be the proper term there, "and he is like death and cannot be satisfied. He gathers to himself all nations and heaps up for himself all peoples." So verse 4 and 5 is pretty much the answer of, why are you doing this, God? Why are you bringing the Babylonians? And his answer is, essentially, trust me. Have faith. Yeah, these people are very wicked. They're very haughty. They're very proud. And he's not staying at home. His desires are large. He's going to bring destruction. But the righteous will live by faith. The just shall live by his faith. Have y'all heard of Habakkuk 2, verse 4, somewhere else? Y'all familiar with it from somewhere else in Scripture? It's quoted 3 times in the New Testament. Paul quotes it twice, once in Romans and once in Galatians, and then the Hebrew writer quotes it as well. Now, they make different applications from this verse, But the ultimate point is, I'm God, you're Habakkuk, I know you don't understand, trust me. Do we need to know anything else beyond that? Do you remember, we talked about Job just a moment ago. You remember what God finally said when he finally answered Job? What was the gist of God's response to Job? When Job was consistently asking, why? Do y'all remember? Basically the same thing. I'm God, you're Job. Where were you when I formed the earth? Where were you when I did all these great works? Who were you, kind of, to question me? I'm God, you're Job, and do you remember what Job's response was? I'm going to put my mouth over, my hand over my mouth, not question anymore. And God's telling Habakkuk, don't worry, I've got this. I'm in control. I'm sovereign here. And yeah, it's going to be bad. But the righteous, the just, they will live by their faith. So just continue to trust in me. And that's the bulk of his response there. Questions, comments about that point? All right, continue on in verse 6. Starting in verse 6 and going through the end of the chapter, what you have is a series of woes pronounced upon the Babylonians. Now, his answer is not quite yet done, because what is the, besides him saying, I'm God, trust me, live by faith, what does he end up saying in this section about the Babylonians? What's going to happen to them? Yeah, they're going to be taken care of. They're going to be overcome. I'm using them right now to judge Judah, but they themselves will be judged. And that's what you have in verse 6 through the rest of the chapter, is this series of woes, which is a way of pronouncing judgment. And it's upon the Babylonians for their actions and who they are. Okay? Go to the end of the chapter, chapter 2, and here we come to another key verse of Habakkuk, and that's Habakkuk 2, verse 20. And there it says, but the Lord is in his holy temple, let all the earth keep silence before him. And we have a song that we sometimes sing, at least I don't know if we've sung it since I've been here or not, but that's all it is. It's just this verse. The Lord is in his holy temple, let all the earth keep silence before him. In the context, what's the point there? What is God saying, or Habakkuk, God through Habakkuk saying, when he says, but the Lord is in his holy temple, let all the earth keep silence before him? Yeah. He's in charge, I'm God, you're not. It doesn't seem like God's doing anything. It doesn't seem like God is rectifying the situation. It doesn't seem like he's acting at all. But God says, yeah, I am. I'm here. I'm in my holy temple. And all the earth needs to fear me. All the earth needs to be silent before me and respect me. And he's going to show himself soon enough. So that kind of parallels verse 4, where he says, the just shall live by his faith, that includes recognizing God is still in his temple. He's still reigning. And I cannot emphasize enough the applicability of Habakkuk to us today. This is something we need to hear. This is something we need to remember. When we read the headlines or you watch the late night news, I don't know about you, I don't read the news or watch the news because it seems like every bit of it's negative. I don't want to hear every day about the various murders or teachers having sexual relationships with their kids or their students. And, you know, I don't want to hear all that. But hearing those things from time to time, that's what makes us ask the question, where are you, God? What are you doing? He's in his temple. Okay. All right, questions? Chapter 3, you have the psalm, the prayer And after God has answered him, this is pretty much an affirmation of Habakkuk's faith in God. Three different parts. The first part of it, he just talks about the character of God and how powerful he is. He talks about him coming in judgment. And then I want you to pay special attention to the end of the psalm, verses 16 through 19. This is where, after it's all said and done, Habakkuk is saying, I trust you, Lord. So, verse 16, he says, when I heard, in other words, heard all the pronouncements by God and what he said he's going to do, when I heard, my body trembled, my lips quivered at the voice, rottenness entered my bones, and I trembled in myself that I might rest in the day of trouble. When he comes up to the people, he will invade them with his troops. Okay, just think about that for a moment. Let's try to put ourselves in Habakkuk's shoes. I'm not a prophet. I'm not a son of a prophet. I don't claim to be. I don't even play one on TV. I don't know what's going to happen to this country. But let's just say Russia, harking back to the days of the Cold War, or let's just say China, or maybe some other world power. Maybe it's not even necessarily a country, but a movement. What is a major movement happening right now that is battling against this country and other countries?
Babylon.
Say that again? Yeah, kind of ironic, isn't it, that it's all part of the same area of the world, but the movement is ISIS or ISIL, you know, whichever one you want to call them. You have these Islamic terrorists. I don't know what's going to happen, but let's just say that God broke pattern and gave us a revelation tonight. You've been asking when I'm going to handle everything in your country? Well, I'll tell you what. I'm bringing all the Islamic terrorists over. They're invading your country. They're already here. We already know that. But they're going to come even more. And within 5 years, this country is going to fall to ISIS. DC will be no more. Millions of Americans killed. What do you think our response would be?
Same as
Habakkuk. They're worse than we are. Absolutely. I guess it depends on what you want to compare, but you would think overall that's the case. What did you say? Move to Australia. Do you think we would be shaking in our boots a little bit? Quivering? Read again with me, verse 16. When I heard, my body trembled. My lips quivered at the voice. Rottenness entered my bones, and I trembled in myself that I might rest in the day of trouble. When he comes up to the people, he will invade them with his troops. I have to admit, I'd be scared. Because life as we know it will be no more. And many of us may be no more for all we know. Keep going though. In spite of all that, verse 17, though the fig tree may not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, though the labor of the olive may fail, and the fields yield no food, though the flock may be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls. He's using all these terms of the fruit trees and flocks and so forth to describe just how bad the situation is. Though all of that be the case, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength. He will make my feet like deer's feet, and he will make me walk on high hills. That's faith. The just shall live by his faith. And so, big lesson of Habakkuk. Very simple message, very simple lesson, still applicable in the 21st century, 2,600 years later, is trust in God. Have faith in God, even as bad as it is now and even as bad as it will be in the future. God's in control. And have faith in him. So, it may be scary. Our future may be pretty scary. I don't know. It doesn't matter. God's got it. And he knows what he's doing. So, Ken?
People that are taking ammunition and guns and Mm-hmm. They can store up, and they're expected something like that.
And, you know, you have these conspiracists and you people preparing for the apocalypse and all that kind of stuff. You know what? If God's behind it, you think that's going to really matter? Think it's going to save them at all? No. It's not going to do any good. But having faith that no matter what happens, no matter what comes, that God is in control and that he knows what he's doing and it's for the good of the people overall, then that's what matters. That's what counts. Okay, any other final observations, comments? Okay, one other contemporary of Habakkuk that I didn't mention before, but is in the same time frame. In fact, he started prophesying before Habakkuk prophesied, but his ministry stretched a much longer period, and that's why I'm saving it for next week, is what major prophet? I think I heard it. Jeremiah. Jeremiah. So next week, you got to read however many chapters in Jeremiah, okay? What is it? 50-something chapters? 40-something chapters? I didn't even bother looking. So read all of that before next Wednesday. Got it, Lanny? Be prepared to talk about the prophet Jeremiah and his ministry. All right, thank you.